morning. Welcome to our meeting, 9 a.m. October 22nd, 2024. And time to convene a regular meeting on the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. Joining me today are Commissioner Tony Olson, our Vice President, Commissioner Rebecca Wolf, our Secretary, Jason Zdechowski, Chief Energy Resource Officer, Brenda Andrade, Acting Legal Officer, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices at this time. This session is for the Board and the CEO General Manager to study and discuss issues among ourselves and the PUD staff. So first on our agenda is item one, our CEO General Manager briefing and study session. And we have Chief Energy Resource Officer Jason Zdechowski to facilitate that discussion.
All right.
Much abbreviated title.
Yes.
Oh, yes. I like it. Actually, I sent John a big plus.
Still maybe the longest title.
No.
Four words.
Yeah, well, I had to do a comparison. All right. Well, thank you, commissioners. We've got a wonderful agenda this morning, a number of presentations here, and we will start with Dana Powell in our retiree benefit program.
Thank you. So we're going to talk about the retiree benefit program document, the program and the document, and then also the future approval of the commission resolution on the next meeting on November 5th. So basically, the umbrella document or the retiree benefit program document should set forth the retiree benefit elements, when the eligibility, what plans are covered, guidelines. It should consolidate all of the provisions throughout the commission resolutions that have happened over decades in one document. But unfortunately, there's been many draft attempts over the years, a lot of years. Brenda actually said, yeah, I think since I've started here, 14 years ago, we've tried to complete this. So here we are. We're going to be completing it, hopefully, in the near future. But it doesn't mean that we haven't communicated retiree program document information. In the past, we've had a lot of words over on the left, just a visual, lots of words. So we really basically had to explain everything that we wrote. but since then, we've kind of done more communications, more fun communications, working with the corporate communications department. And you can see a screenshot of what that brochure looks like, countdown to retirement brochure. So it's kind of a fun way to summarize all the provisions. There is a lot of history. These are just a few, not all, that relate to retiree benefit program provisions and plans. Probably the one first going back there in the 1980s was basically saying that upon immediate retirement under PERS, then you're offered retiree health benefits here at the district. Various changes along the way. There was a legacy retiree life plan that stopped in the mid-80s. In the mid-80s, started the $180 into the FSA at that point. But then in 2005, it changed to an HRA, so another benefit terminology. But with that one, that account balance rolls over each year. So that was kind of a nice enhancement there. But one of the most biggest changes was back in 2009. So employees hired after July 1st of that year basically received money. At that time, it started off with $50 into an RHS, which is Retirement Health Savings Account, while they're employed. And then they can use that monies upon separation or retirement, actually. And then you need 120 consecutive months to be eligible for service pay. So basically 10 years of service to get that service pay. So that was a big change there. And again, the RHS was kind of offsetting the district contribution towards medical. And I'll kind of show that here in a little bit. And then had already come to the commission earlier this year as a result of the union negotiation changes. So there was a few changes increasing the RHS contribution again to $125 a month and offering COBRA subsidy upon death for an employee or a retiree for up to 12 months. So those will be incorporated into this new plan document. And then also some rate changes, contribution changes, and I'll get into that here in a little bit detail. And this is kind of a visual, again, of those differentiators between the programs that were split out in 2009. So to the left, you know, offered medical or the HRA plan, health reimbursement arrangement. It's one or the other under age 65. And when someone turns 65, they were hired before that year, then they're only offered the HRA, the $180 for the rest of their life. And then I kind of put the numbers just so you can get kind of an idea. We still have about a little less than 350 active employees that are still eligible for that plan in that program. And it kind of tying it back to the annual report, the liability of that benefit coverage falls under OPEB, which is other post-employment benefit liability. So that, as you can see, that liability is going down, but there is a significant cost to that program compared to hired after July 1st of 2009. Again, upon taking of HERS retirement, those employees are offered medical and vision, but they do pay 100% of the premium, but they would use that RHS funds to pay, could pay for reimbursements out of that RHS account upon separation. And then once people, then once you turn 65, then there's no new plan. But again, you can use the RHS funds for any out-of-pocket reimbursement. Just stop if you have any questions. And then this is, I guess, more demographics. Kind of on the left, this is how many active retirees we have that were hired before 7/9. So we have about 83 retirees that are holding medical still. So they're under 65, them or their spouses or family members. So we do offer that coverage as well. And we have about 600, almost 650 retirees on the HRA plan. So and they're not eligible for the RHS. That retiree life plan, again, that was grandfathered in the mid 80s. There's still about 182 retirees with that plan. So we do have quite a bit of retirees that we manage and talk to when they give us a call, so they can still reach out to us with questions. And not a lot of data other than the active employees, about 888, but there are none enrolled currently in the retiree medical plan that were hired after July 1st of 2009. We have one every now and then, but they're not on the plan as much just because they usually are a little bit, they're closer to the Medicare coverage age, so they're only on for a short period of time, it seems. There was a few changes during COVID, but we began offering COBRA dental upon retirement for up to 18 months, and then allowing retirees to drop spouses and children mid-year for any reason. And we can, it's a little bit more flexibility on the retiree plan because it's a post-tax premium. And it was, we had some issues where retirees had some issues paying those premiums. And so it was like, why not allow them to stop paying that and not harm them unnecessarily? So, but on the flip side, they still do have to have a qualified life event, which would be marriage, loss of other coverage, or something like that to add those dependent back onto the plan mid-year or wait till next open enrollment. But these changes were cost neutral to the district, so they didn't come through as a resolution. And then the resolution number is the 6173 was what we brought forward out of negotiations, but there's two new dental plans. Delta Dental is offering standard and premium, but it's basically a fully insured plan, and that enrollment could be directly through them. So we just sent a mailing out to all 700 retirees. So we're getting a few calls, but we're also going to be offering a presentation so they can come in with questions. So there could be a lot of retirees coming in on October 30th to get some questions answered with that dental plan. But we're having the vendor fair on that day through our open enrollment. So we'll have Delta Dental representatives on site to ask questions. But if they do enroll in that, they would pay directly to Delta Dental, not to the PUD. But we've heard a lot of positive information about, or positive questions and kudos on that. So that was a good, nice add. Dental has been kind of a missing piece in the retiree world. And then again, I already mentioned kind of the, if a retiree passes away, the district does pay The COBRA premium for 12 months at 100%. COBRA is offered up to 36 months in that situation upon a death of a retiree or an employee, actually. And again, there was some rate changes and coverage changes and contribution changes as a result of the negotiation. So I just put some screenshots. The coverage levels, instead of single, double, multiple, they're changing to a four tier. So instead of a three tier, as you can see there, for retiree spouse, children, and family. And so these are the current rates, and I'm not going to go through all of those because it's a lot of numbers, but biggest difference is that the current contribution is 75% of the most selected plan and coverage level, which is PPO plan, single coverage. So basically that you see that 12, 17, 15 repeated. So that's 75% of the 1,622.86. And that's how the current structure rates work on the three-tier program and the vision rates. So right now, I'll just kind of point to a couple numbers. We have very low enrollment in the HMO plan. So most of our retirees are enrolled in that, obviously the medical PPO single coverage. So right now they're paying $405.71. And on the next slide, you'll see how it flips. The cost currently for single coverage is $16.22, but that's kind of what we had referred to. The philosophy for many years was a subsidized rate. But really the true cost of a one person being on the plan is, these are the rates for 2025. So in this case, that in that same scenario, an employee only or a retiree only, sorry, on the PPO plan, the true cost is $988.32. So now the district, so both the rate and the contribution are going down for that coverage. And so therefore the out-of-pocket rate for the retiree is going down as well. So that's a good news. And even the highest, which we have maybe 3 to 5, I think, retirees enrolled in the family plan, the 728.82 next year is even less than the 769.97 currently. So actually, in that case, the good news is that all the rates are going down for the out-of-pocket to the retirees.
So I'm sorry, why are rates going down?
Because of the philosophy and the structure change. So instead of having subsidized rates that we currently do, so and having one contribution for all of the rates,
I understand. Okay.
So if we, yeah, so
the cost of insurance is going down.
Correct. Okay. Being more, it's true, yeah. Cost of what one person versus two adults versus a family is costing.
Right.
So. And then it made sense to then change the district's contribution formula to not be a flat 75% per one plan, because you're increasing that, you know, the highest rate up to the 2,900. It made sense to change the contribution based on the plan and the coverage level at the same time. So, and then we're still offering the vision and again, the similar breakout rates for the four tiers as well. Other than that, we're just going to bring forward the commission resolution to approve the complete benefits program document. It won't go into details with the rates. That was just more kind of education to kind of explain kind of those bigger changes, but those you can kind of see in the numbers there. And then if approved, we would be mailing out the retiree benefit program document. How many pages did it ended up, like 40 or so, to the retirees. And we would be sending it to the retirees under age 65 on medical, because the retirees on the HRA plan, they have a separate plan document for the HRA plan. And really, they don't have life event changes or eligibility from that perspective. So it would be to a little less than 100 people that we would be sending.
Questions?
No.
Thank you. Yes. As you know, retiree benefits are near and dear to my heart.
You're near to mine too.
The question I have, this is a benefit, so therefore the elected officials fall under that because we receive all the benefits of an employee, correct?
Most of the benefits. So there's the RHS benefit, and there's like some time off benefits that don't apply to commissioners.
Got it.
But the option to potentially retire and then receive you know, under 65, if you're hired after 7/1/09, you could be offered the medical up to age 65 upon taking a PERS retirement. So there's all those little nuances, but yes, those could apply if in that case.
And when I guess I retire again, does all this apply to my second retirement?
Yes. Okay. There is a specific resolution that was written, not just specifically for you, but in the case of a...
I kind of think it was.
Actually, well, you might have been. And a few others, where if you take, where if somebody hired prior to 7/1/09 took a PERS retirement and was rehired and then re-retires, we didn't want them to lose out on that benefit program that they'd already retired under. So there is that caveat that yes, you would apply to that previously, so...
I have no more questions because I think these just relate to me and I don't want to take this.
So I just have a quick question.
Yes.
So none of this changes the benefits. We're just using one resolution to cover everything.
And incorporate it into this official plan document.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
I just want to say I know that that was a lot of work to get all of those years into.
14 years.
I know. So congratulations for that.
Thank you very much, Dana. Up next, we have Jessica Raw Holmgren, facilities planning and engineering group. And Jessica's going to give an update on the North County Community Office. Just mention one quick thing here. We do have an amendment for the North County Community Office project on the agenda this afternoon. This is meant to just be a general update on the project, and then the team will be back this afternoon to answer any questions associated with it.
Good morning. Hi. So my name is Jessica. I am, as Jason said, I'm the manager of facilities planning and engineering. Just wanted to give you, like he said, a quick update, just information for you only. This is kind of the fun presentation. We get to show some fun pictures. So as you remember, we have our new community office in Arlington that's replacing the Stanwood and Arlington local offices, which have been, it's been long overdue. So we're really excited for this project. I think we've had some visitors. So Commissioner Wolf and Commissioner Logan have come to see us, and hopefully Commissioner Wilson can come when we do the opening. But here's just some pictures. The bottom one here is just when we started. You can see some of the steel and where the warehouse foundations are getting put together. We have a really cool time lapse that we're going to be able to show when we get a little bit closer to opening, so that's going to be fun. So when we designed this facility, we wanted to make sure that we had flexibility, that it was designed to be resilient, a 50-year building, and really make sure that it serves the district's need for quite a few years. So just a quick timeline here on design. Started in earnest. This project has been kind of been in mind before 2020, but design in earnest started in 2020, went to 2022. We did early site work for this project. So we prepared the ground, we put in infrastructure in the ground, and just kind of wanted to get ready for that the time when we started the actual buildings. And then construction is started in 22, and we're looking to fully finish on March 17th, 2025. So next spring, we are planning on opening the doors on March 17th, which is really exciting. So we have some more fun pictures. So if you haven't driven by yet on 59th, this is what the building looks like right now. It looks done and ready to go, but inside there are a lot of busy bees still working and trying to get things ready. So it turned out beautifully. We're very proud. I'm very proud. My team has worked very hard over the last few years to get this done. So it's fantastic. But so there's the outside. Here's some photos of the office building. I didn't put a ton in here. There's a lot going on, a lot of ladders, which doesn't make for an exciting photo. But you can see here the break area on the upper left just kind of has an idea of the nice space windows. There's a door there that goes outside for folks to be able to eat lunch outside or just kind of make a phone call or whatever they want to do out there. Down below in the lower left, we have the open office area. You'll see we have some floor protection down just over the carpet. So the carpet looks much better underneath there, but we're going to have furniture, workstations there, a couple offices will be built in there. So that's just a quick glimpse of that on the first floor. Upper right, we have the CSR area that furniture is being installed right now. So that just gives you kind of a glimpse of what that looks like. And then the lower right is the, there's a conference room up in that CSR area that customers can come and visit and meet with engineers and do any kind of meetings there. So that's kind of more of a public facing conference room. Some shots of the warehouse. So the warehouse is, it's a large cavern right now. It's pretty exciting. I think the warehouse folks from the two offices are going to be very impressed with the space they have here. So just a peek there. We have quite a large tool room that's going to be great for that team as well. And here's on the right, a shot of the breezeway between the office and the warehouse, which we are really excited. It's going to be another great place for employees to the outside, and so we're really excited about that. Some nice furniture and some tables for folks there. And a few shots of the loading dock. So this is quite an enormous loading dock when you're next to it. So we have on-grade loading, we have a 4-foot dock and a 2-foot dock. So we have some different options depending on what the crews are doing. Which is great. So pull through for safety. We've got, you can kind of see on the lower right, there's a shot looking from the on grade back towards the warehouse and those 2 and 4 foot docks there.
The number of bays, I was trying to count. What are the number of bays here?
You know, there's, I have to look at the plan again. Do you happen to know how many bays there are?
Not a big deal. I just,
off the top of my head, I don't.
It's supporting how many crews then?
We have 12 loading dock bays and then,
wow.
And then space for another 6 on grade should be pull through with 3 trucks in each.
Yeah. So we've planned for day 1 to have 5 crews in this site.
Yeah.
It's designed to support 10. So with future growth and development there. So yeah, we're planning for that, but anyone, they're going to have plenty of space. So just to give you a few more little tidbits here, we originally had this opening in October, so it was originally supposed to open this month. We've had some additional mechanical, electrical, plumbing things that we need to work out and finish up with the contractor, so that's one thing that put us a little bit behind. We also have an emergency responder system that we had to install, which we didn't know we needed until we had all the envelope completed. And so they do this test and so the fire department can use their radios inside the building and communicate. So that's something, had a long lead time and we aren't able to open the building without it. So that's one thing that pushed us back. It's also really close to storm season right now. And so we were pretty uncomfortable moving forward with that, just in case there were any hiccups. So we wanted to make sure we were prepared for storm season. And as you can imagine, it takes a lot of time to outfit a building like this. So we have furniture, fixtures, signage, I mean, everything that you can think of that's going into this building. So that takes quite a bit of time for us to do that as well. Just the next steps, kind of where we're sitting right now. Right now we have temporary certificate of occupancy for the building. So we're able to go in with the contractor and start our work as far as putting all those furniture, that signage, all these things that kind of fit it out. So that's really helpful. It's not ready for occupancy by everyone yet. So it's just kind of those few that are working the construction of the building. The facilities shop is actually moving in right now, so they can help us with that fit out, which is fantastic. So they're supporting us up there. And the warehouse is actually going to start labeling racks and start their process of getting ready to put product in the building. So that's also a big milestone there. We also have a fuel island here that will be opening before March. We're trying to work out and that finished up right now, so the crews will be able to use that. We don't have an exact date when that'll be done, but the plan is to open that a little bit early for their convenience. And then, yeah, once everybody's moved in here in March, we'll begin the process of preparing Stanwood and Arlington offices for surplus. Not sure how we have done this, so we're not sure how long that's going to take, but maybe late summer, midsummer, we're not sure yet, but those will be prepped for that. And yeah, again, I'm really proud of my team. They've done an amazing job. Mark, the project lead, Mark Gervin is here. So all the people to do this. So that's an update for us.
Yeah, what are the eyes of March?
Well, it's funny, the 17th is that day. We figured it's a lucky day.
I'm hoping.
It's a Monday, you know.
That doesn't bode well, does it?
Well, I'm thinking about it because I will not be here on March 17th. I would have been on October, whatever. But I was wondering, this, when you open on the 17th, is that going to be for the public?
Yes.
Like me?
Yes. Yes. And we'll invite you to the special parties.
Oh, really? Yes. Thank you. I'm so grateful.
Yes.
I love this project.
Oh, good, good.
And I'm sure you do. It's at your backyard.
I'm excited.
You've decided what?
I'm excited.
Oh, you're excited. I have a 1, 2, 3. Is there, you may have mentioned it, Mitch, public meeting space.
Yes.
Is there public meeting space?
Yes, we do have public meeting space. We have two conference rooms, so we can split a big
room. Oh, it's in the conference room.
Yes,
okay.
Yeah, and that's up in the front. There's a nice lobby when you come in, and you can either go to customer service or to the left is a large room. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
And there's a picture of the warehouse. I'm assuming that's just one area of the warehouse.
This is just one area.
Okay, because I think it'd have to be a pretty substantial
It is. So this
to support
is,
that many crews.
Yeah, it is. And kind of what would be behind you in that photo is the tool room. There's the doors, that the rolling doors where they would receive material from the loading dock. And so there's an office kind of to the right. So I really need a 360 camera or something like that. But yeah, it is. It has all that stuff in it too.
And then my third question, which is just, There have been some slight delays in this project. Was supply chain another issue?
It was.
You didn't mention it. So.
Yes, it was.
Okay.
Especially at the beginning of the project, that
okay.
was definitely an issue.
Yeah.
So, and we have some things that are actually still on order. An automatic transfer switch won't be here until next year. So, and it's been on order for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So, a few, but it's getting better.
Oh, is there going to be cost savings in terms of not having to move so much from the officer in terms of delivering, going to be a lot of cost saving.
Yes, yeah.
Since it's right on site. Thank you.
I just have a few questions.
Yes.
So how many crews do we have at Arlington now?
We have two crews, if I remember correctly. Two crews at Arlington, two crews at Stanwood would be the four, and then the fifth is going to be a group that will serve Marysville out of ops.
Okay. So Stanwood will close when this opens.
Correct.
Okay. So in March, will everything be ready? We'll have all the tools and
Yeah, that's the idea. Is we're going to be closing, and most of it is with the customer service. You know, we want to make sure for our customers we're closed on a Friday, and then they can show up at the new office on Monday. But we'll be able to behind the scenes be able to move folks in and office folks and crews and make sure, but. The main opening is just for, we set that date mostly for the public to be able to join us. So
it's amazing what we've been able to do with that tiny little space in Arlington. So for those that haven't been there, I think the parking lot is maybe four times the size of this room.
Yes.
And the trucks are full size. So
yes.
It's always amazing to see. So
it is really exciting to have Brett and his groups and different folks come through and just be wowed by it. So
yeah.
Very proud of it.
The other thing that's interesting is because I drive by this building every day, at least once a day, and that orange insulation was there for a long time before it was covered. And so I would get questions of why is PD building a bright red orange building? And I kept saying that looks like insulation to me.
Yeah. I was looking at the rendering and I thought, are we building a
Yep. It was like that for a long time.
Yeah.
So I you know, when we got the tour, it's an impressive building, very large area for crews area. I think there's an area for employees to work out.
Yes, we have a wellness center
exercise,
as well. Yep.
So,
yeah, we have a wellness center. And that was one of the pictures that was full of ladders.
Yeah. And so now the question I get is that where my new office is?
We get that a lot.
And I say, I don't have an office.
Well, we will have drop-in stations, so
yeah.
If you ever wanted to come visit.
And then the next question is, can I buy the old office? Everyone wants to buy that building because it's in a good spot downtown.
It is in a great spot, and that's kind of the surplus process with real estate.
Yeah.
But yeah, we get it ready.
Arlington.
Yeah. So we'll get it all prepped and ready for sale.
Commissioners, any follow-up questions?
I was babysitting all day yesterday, and I showed the almost two-year-old your pictures Oh. And I expanded it because he loves trucks.
Oh.
And so we got to look at all that. He learned a new word, building.
All right.
Building.
Well, maybe he can come work with us someday.
Oh, he's so wonderful.
Yeah.
Control.
I have one more.
Yes.
Staffing of the warehouse. Now, I may not be asking the right person, but we're going to transfer warehouse people from ops. Some of them, or are we going to add staffing?
Here, so we do have some. I am not the best person to ask, just because of the staffing portion. But there are some folks coming from ops. If I don't know, Scott can answer.
Probably,
I know Claudia is not.
As it expands, probably over time.
Yeah,
we are a resident expert.
Yeah. Claudia, who's the warehouse manager, reports up through Angela and I. But we have several moving parts actually on the warehouse. We've got some time limited warehouse folks that are coming on for AMI. We've got a 75th Street warehouse there. And then we've got some offsite warehouse folks at the various locations. So there's a little bit of juggling right now on warehouse. We've added a couple of time limited folks, and then we've shifted, we've kind of backfilled some of them into the traditional warehouse and moved some of our more experienced folks out into this location and some of the AMI staging. So there's a little bit of shuffling, but yeah, it'll be some consolidation, but we might be a plus one, you know, when the dust settles after AMI.
That's what I was just saying.
Right now, it's a little bit trickier because we've got some multiple moving parts because of AMI.
Thank you.
You know, the only other comment I'll make is those of us that live north know the traffic has really gotten worse. Like, so it'll be great for our customers when we have more and more crews up there that are beyond that traffic to help respond to North County incidents.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
But today was a great example of that traffic.
Yeah.
Exactly. Today was a great example of that. There's a huge accident on the interstate.
All right. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
Yeah, super nice presentation. Yeah, super proud of the team and all the work and office there. Okay, next we have Scott Richards, our lead hydro scheduler. He's going to give us a water supply update.
Hello. So it's the first time in front of the commission.
Oh, we'll be fine.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Only one of us bites.
And you look at me.
We have a very special job.
Previously, a colleague of mine, Mike Shatley, have done the water supply updates. That's why I'm here today. And if there are questions as I go, please ask them. Let me wait until you. All right. So the topics, well, I guess for starters, this is information only, so no action needed. Mission part. The topics I'm going to cover today are EPA's slice product, some of the Columbia River Treaty changes, the water supply forecast, both past and present, water supply regulation, what that is, and also the regulated Columbia River flows. But what I will not be covering are any of the district-owned hydro resources and or monthly breakdowns of precip or temperature. And in total, there are 7 slices of presentation, so it should go very quick.
Before you go on, why are we not including the district owned hydro resources? If you know.
So the two things in my mind are this time of year, a lot of the smaller district owned hydro resources aren't generating.
Right.
And typically you're offline during the summer. That's one thing. So there's not a whole lot to update you on until they start back up in the winter. And the second thing is a order of magnitude, how big are the resources are. So not to say they aren't important in terms of megawatts.
They are part of the picture, the whole picture. I guess you're not looking so much at the financial side. Yes. You're just looking at, well, when you talk about slice, and then I think it's about finance. But anyway, not to interrupt you, but I was just wondering about that. Thank you.
As far as BPA slice product, that's the majority of what I'm going to talk about today. The district receives approximately 5% share of the Federal Columbia River Power System. That's 31 hydro projects and the Columbia Generating Station. So the output of that approximate 5% share is typically in the 300 to 700 megawatt range, depending on water conditions. So to Commissioner Wolf's question, the magnitude of small changes with the slice resource can often overshadow some of the smaller resources. So today I'm focusing on the piece. And interestingly, the district will switch away from slice and block as of October 1st of next year to load following. So at that point, the district owned resources will be more prominent because we won't want to slice it.
Columbia River Treaty changes. You may have seen headlines in the last 2 or 3 months. One of the biggest headlines is regarding the Canadian entitlement. So that's electricity sent to Canada as payment for the downstream benefits that BPA receives. As of August 1st of 2024, so this last August, the entitlement, which is an obligation, was reduced by 150 average megawatts. So 150 megawatts, that's at BPA scale. We get a percentage of that. So based on approximately 5% share, our reduction or obligation it is about 7 average megawatts. That's normally a good thing. We're gonna have to send less back to Canada, but that 7 average megawatts is small enough that there's a bad water year. It certainly gets obscured by lack of water. Other details of the Columbia River Treaty. I think it went fully into effect late in September, but those are slow to emerge and be disseminated. So this is one particular aspect that I picked out because it's easily quantifiable, but it's certainly not the only change going forward.
Yeah, I have a question on the slide. So I guess I was under the belief, I understand why we're going to go up 7, that makes sense, but that Canada mostly never took the actual energy, they took it as dollars. Do they actually take the energy? I'm trying to understand if the region has more energy because of this. I would say we have the right to more energy. I get that.
So, the 150 megawatts that we're talking about, it's literal energy that won't be sent back. But like with our slice product, we saw that in terms of megawatts. When Canada was taking the energy, we would see the megawatts drop down.
Okay.
When they're not taking energy, we see the megawatts pop back up. As far as whether more energy would be available, it's probably a question for power supply.
Well, I think you answered it. So they do take it sometimes.
They take it when usually it's most valuable, or they need it the most, which is generally the maybe the worst.
When we need it the most, too. Sure. Thank you.
I do have
a yes,
Commissioner. On 4, the starting August 2024, the entitlement was reduced by 150. Isn't this a graduated thing over year number of years?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I don't need the details. I just want to make sure I recall them correctly. Okay.
So the obligation will be reduced further.
Right, over a number of years. Thank you.
Below average water forecasts and lots of uncertainty. So what we're looking at here are our graphs that depict the volume of water forecast for the January through July time period on the Columbia River. And a new forecast is produced each day, which is represented by the walk
box and whisker plot, and it's just added to the graph. And in, for example, 2023, the uncertainty decreases with each additional forecast over the year, and that box and whisker plot gets smaller and smaller and more certain as the year goes on to the right in the graph. On the left-hand side of the slide, the volume forecast for the last two water years started below average. Average is that green line, each of the three graphs. That's the 30-year average. So in 2023, the volume forecast started below average and ultimately ended below average. That green line. Same story in 2024. The water supply forecast started below average, ended below average. In the bottom right graphic, that's this water year, 2025. The one year starts by definition October 1st, so we're about 20 days into the water year. And the volume forecast is, again, currently below average. As far as what's assumed in the future, anything beyond 10 days in the future, the assumption is just average precip and temperatures, because nobody truly knows what's actually going to happen. So we're just using a baseline assumption of average precip and average temp. If the precipitation happens to be above average as the year goes on, that volume forecast to also increase.
So are you saying that they don't use meteorologists to look at what they expect for the winter, whether it's going to be colder or warmer or wetter? It gets the average going forward?
Some of both. So beyond 10 days, they don't attempt to forecast because that's, I think, generally the time frame when they can accurately forecast. So that's just average precip temp inside of 10 days. So now, like through the next 10 days, they do use weather forecasts and join those two together. So we've got 10 days of weather predicted, and beyond that, it's just.
And this is the National Weather, is this the national, or the, what agency is this?
This is from the Northwest River Forecast Center.
Right. But does Bonneville do anything beyond this? I guess I'm just sort of wondering, we always talk about El Nino and La Nina and the effect it has on the hydro system. So it's interesting that they don't, it doesn't really seem to get worked into the forecast.
It doesn't get worked into this forecast. I think BPA's approach is there is a wide range of forecasts, like looking at the box and whisker. So BPA is likely planning for generally as many scenarios as it can accommodate, but rather than particular.
Thank you.
Scott, you know, when we get the BPA 3-month forecast, does that include, you know, some, you know, kind of seasonal expectations, you know, that could come from the Northwest River Forecast Center or be based on La Nina or El Nino?
So what Jason is referencing, it every month BPA gives us a 3-month forecast for our slice output, and that product or forecast from BPA general assumptions as far as flows. BPA has a host of water years that they look at, and they typically take a mean or a median flow, put that in a forecast, and send it our way. So a lot of the 3-month forecasts that we get are still generally representative of average recent temperature.
Yeah, excuse me. Do you include the Northwest Power and Conservation Council data? Northwest Power and Conservation Council?
I don't. Is there specific data?
Well, they do a lot of data gathering about whether they do power and energy forecasting, and also they were created in 1980 by the Northwest Power Act to force the, I mean, to make sure that the BPA does what they have to do. And they do a lot of work. Maybe that's reflected in the BPA.
Yeah, Commissioner Wolf, they look at, it's more of a planning document that they put out. You know, they do an update, and then every 5 to 7 years they put out a new report. So it's not so much looking at you know, seasonal forecasting near term, but more, you know, like resource adequacy.
Right.
How are we
looking
as we look out, you know, 10, 20 years?
Right. Thank you.
So the reason why I'm showing these together forecasts in Lawrence County over like 2 years is because the prior year often impacts the following water year starts. So in this case, 2023 ended below average in terms of water supply forecasts, and lo and behold, 2024 started below average. Same trend with 2024, ended below average, and now 2025. The volume forecast is below average. So if you know the previous water year ended, it gives you a good idea of how the next water year is going to begin. In the table, top right, that just depicts water year forecasts from this decade, 2020 through 2025, and also the high and low of the last 77 years.
So in the graphs on the left, that thin orange band, those are the forecasts. Is that correct? Is that what that is? Has it changed over time?
On the left-hand side graphs, it moves up or down. It changes over time, and a new forecast is added on the right-hand side. Is that
right? I guess I'm trying to understand the 89% and how that compares to those two water years where they started out. And it looks like last year started out a little above 90. But I'm not sure if I'm reading the graphic right.
It's probably not helping you that the percentages are not on the graphic.
That's volume.
Right. So okay, there's the raw number, which is the period volume on the right hand side in million acre feet.
Okay.
So the blue line on each graph is where the water supply forecast end of the year, and then you can kind of track it on the vertical axis.
Okay.
Not just a percentage though. Yeah. It's a little confusing because those percentages and volumes are very similar.
Yeah.
Water supply regulation, what is it? So hydraulic regulation disconnects the inflows, which we looked at on the previous slide, from the outflows. And the regulation is provided by reservoirs behind the dams. So just because you know the inflows, last slide, doesn't necessarily mean you know the regulated outflows. Why the regulated outflows are important is because the Columbia River flows can be regulated weekly, monthly, and even yearly for purposes like flood control, fish, navigation, irrigation, also power generation. So now we're taking a slightly different look. Instead of looking at the inflow forecasts, this is a graph of regulated Columbia River flows. The graph shows 12 months on the horizontal axis, February through September. That's one water year. And then on the vertical axis shows regulated flows in the Columbia River. And the two traces shown on the graph are 2015 and 2023, both of which were below average water years. The purple line, which is 2023, that is a more typical shape that we'd expect in a given year. And the regulated flows peak in the spring. Typically, I think we know about floods. Those happens in a typical year. The other trace is 2015, and that the regulated flows in that particular year or in February, essentially middle of winter. And what happened there was the rain came, precipitation came as rain beds. So large volume water came during the winter, and we look later in the year. You're not getting anywhere as high of flows in the springtime frame where you typically do get the higher flows is slightly known. So that's why I say accurately forecasting regulated flows and slight generation is challenging because both top matters. These are two below average water years, but they have drastically different regulated flows and also drastically different slight generation profiles. So the takeaway is even if you know the average regulated flow over the year, there's still significant uncertainty on when the water will go up and the associated generation that goes along with it. As far as next steps, the next water supply update will be given to the commission in April. So if there are things that you liked about this presentation or things you'd like to see in the next presentation, like some higher. Questions?
I think about longer term. It seems that this is kind of a trend now. Is that a dangerous thing to talk about? It seems like that this is just how it's going to be, maybe for a long time. I mean, maybe you shouldn't commit yourself.
So when we're talking about trends, I think the thing that's undisputed is if we look at the last water years since 2020 through current, they're all generally either average or below in terms of water supply. So it certainly gets you thinking if it's not a trend, then what is it and how long is it going to take to?
I appreciate it.
But I think in general, trying to get the district trying to prepare for all the possible scenarios.
That's about that. That's a good answer. That's a good answer.
Just clarification on observation for me. So should I feel good, okay, or bad about 2025 with regard to available generation? Okay.
Okay.
The net needed generation.
Yeah, I'd say okay.
Okay, thank you.
I think the important part is being vigilant, knowing, planning for what you expect. So you're planning.
And we have the ability to do that. So, okay, thank you.
I was thinking worry until the end of April. I'm sure. Just worry until the end of April. I mean, this graph is really phenomenally different.
Yeah.
If you looked at load relative to this, you could really see a water year like 2023, what a difference. Their cold snaps and stuff. So it's just interesting. So this is the actual the Dalles is that the most upstream of the dam. So this is the actual flow of the river. This doesn't have impound or.
It is the second to last dam on the Columbia River.
Oh,
so
the bottom. Okay.
Yeah, generally everything filters through this particular project, which is why it's kind of used as a proxy for the entire system.
Okay,
you're just going to use.
But impounding up above it can affect this, the timing, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Whether that's on a week, month.
Yeah. Okay. Any other follow-up questions?
Well, I'm remembering, I believe it was true that when we were having so much rain and very little snow, Oregon was having quite a bit of snow in that same time period. That's kind of weird. It's like, is this a plot against the skiers?
So I'd say that the good thing about the benefits of the Columbia River Basin is pretty large. And so even if you get above average or below average in one part, you have a big enough area to smooth out the hiccups that you're talking about.
Thank you very much, Scott. Nice job.
Thank you very much, Scott. And
Jason, let's take a short break and come back at 10. Sounds good. All right, it is 10 and we are back.
All right, thank you very much. And thank you, Scott, for that last presentation. And it's a wonderful segue to this presentation, our energy risk management report and how we manage that risk. I'll introduce Peter Dauenhauer, Senior Manager of Economics, Energy and Risk Management, and also acknowledge Felicia Dean, who Principal Economist and contributed to this presentation.
Good morning, Commissioners. We've forgot rates in there. We also do rates in the department, minor aspect of what we do.
Very important to the customer.
No, I'm just joking. But yes, Peter Downhauer here, Senior Manager of Rates, Economics, Energy Risk Management, and acknowledging Felicien for her contributions to this presentation as well. So I'm going to have a hard time beating the last one. So I tried to have some nice graphics. I hope you're interested in looking at some data and graphics. But the North County, I think, takes it for the best pictures. I can't beat that. And some really good, great graphs out of Scott with the water report there. But what we're going to be looking at is how the energy risk management program went in the last 6 months. And we're going to start out by looking at some of the background principles of what we do, and then kind of look forward to what's in the future. So the purpose of the presentation is to brief you on this. And that's just information only. Here's a list of all our recent meetings. We've had it quarterly, and then we go to the biannual risk report going back to 2021 here. At some point, the text will get too small, and we'll have to start cutting off some of the last ones, but that point is not yet reached. So there you go. As I said, the agenda is to look at our background, the fundamentals, then look at some sources of risk, look at the last 6 months in retrospect, and then finish with the risk program. So a little bit about the background of the program. We make our best efforts to anticipate both the consumption of electric power by its customers and our supply that we have available. And we engage in transactions to meet the customer needs in a dependable, safe, responsible manner. And these transactions include buying and selling, scheduling of electric power, options for electric power, and other energy commodities as necessary to meet those loads and mitigate our risks. Some of our key strategies here, we define and update our uncertainty and risks related to our resources and load demand, and also to market prices. And we keep our monthly market position near neutral in the short term. And short term is 36 months ahead. And we do that by keeping our exposure to market prices below our limits. Limits are set to cap the impacts of market movements, no more than a 3% rate increase. We also reduce risks from in-month balancing that may occur. And we transact market operations over time to average out some of the variations that we see in the market, what we call a glide path. So let's have a look at some of the sources of risks. So last time we showed you this graphic, so this might be just a refresher on that, but we have both resources and loads, and that's depicted on the graph that you see in the box plot there. And you can see through those items there that there's some variation over time. So let's just start with the blue boxes. Those are our resources. And really just focusing on the line that goes through the center of each one of those boxes, that's what we expect our resources will be able to deliver throughout the course of the year. But then in some months, see there's quite a bit of variation. Let's take February, for example, if you just look at that one. Those lines that you see that extend off the box have happened or could happen. However, most of the time, what we expect is what's in the area of the box. And so we can also do the same with loads. Again, taking February for an example, you can see the box is similar size, maybe a little smaller, but generally a little bit lower than the resources. So on average, we think the difference between those two points is kind of what our net balance is going to be. But it is possible that we could have more loads than resources at different times. And that's kind of what those different ends of the lines could represent. You see very clearly May, June, July, we typically have a lot more resources than we do loads. And in the winter months, things are getting a lot tighter. And some deviations from what we expect can result in periods where we need a lot more than we typically do. So this is meant to give you a sense of kind of what the resource and loads look like typically during the year and some of the variation that we see. As we go through the year, we're revising these forecasts regularly whenever we get new information.
So is that graphic for,
time period looks at, this is looking at the last 5 years or so, January 2019
okay.
through 2024.
So it's not a specific year.
Not a specific year.
Okay.
This is some sort of summary statistics from that period of time. And we also know that we've got price variability. So typically prices have kind of a floor of zero or near zero. And the metric we're looking at here is day ahead prices. So what's the price for tomorrow during the middle of the day, evenings? Those are heavy load and light load prices, right? And again, we see different the box plots versus different months of the year. Didn't show up very well in the graphic on the screen here, but maybe in the printouts it does. But we've highlighted the winter months there. But we showed in the previous slide, you know, where it's a little bit tighter, right? And so during these months, we have a higher likelihood of being caught a bit short. And, you know, we want to know what the prices are during those periods of time too. So a couple things to kind of point out here is most of the time, the center of those boxes, what we expect the prices are going to be. See, that's pretty low, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at the range of the boxes, even in January, I think we've got the largest range. Again, this is over the last 5 years. And on the top of that box is at about $100 per megawatt hour, $100 per megawatt hour. But some of the deviations can be pretty extreme, right? And that's what we're seeing. We know about these kind of blowouts or prices get pretty high. So really it's these types of variabilities that we're trying to protect against in our risk program. Also last time we talked about the adjustment we made to our target positions. So these are the reserves we hold. We hold a little bit extra going into the month to make sure that we, when we need it, we have it. Obviously we can't hold everything that we could possibly need at all times. So we try to find a nice balance, and this was the adjustment that was made. There is no scale on the Y. We don't want to show our exact positions here, but you can see the relative comparison between the old reserves and the new reserves. And just noting that, as we're going into the winter months on the edges of the graph, pretty significantly higher than it was in the past. And in addition, also can look at some of the summer months where we've seen some price variability, in particular July and August, where we've had some higher targets than we typically have. We did this to align with our integrated resource plan. At the time, we were doing it to bridge for resource adequacy requirements. And we put these in place for the following 36 months. So that's a refresher of what we did last time. And the next slide here is kind of how's it looking going into this winter, right? So there's a few things here to point out. This is our forward position outlook. And what I've done is I've looked at just the winter months, comparing this year, looking at this winter versus last year, looking at last winter, and how many megawatt hours, how much volume we've already procured. And that's on that left-hand side graphic. And that's probably the most important one to look at. You can see it's about 2.1 times larger amount of volume than we've had this time last year. In terms of where we want to get to, the second graph shows you that the blue bar, we're about 96% of what we want to be, where we want to be. So we're pretty close to those targets. Albeit those targets are talking about a larger volume than they were last year. Interesting to see that in 2023, we actually had more than what we were targeting at this point. We were over 100% there. We're again sort of positioning ourselves more conservatively than we have in the past. And then the final graphic there on the right-hand side, the percentage that we procured over the next 12 months. So this is going through the whole water year. And we have more than our targets would suggest. You know, that would suggest we're going to be probably selling some of this extra length over time. But The takeaway is, you know, it's winter, we're in a strong position over the course of the year, and you know, we're also in a strong position.
So when you say procured, that means slice and other contracts that we've gone out and made purchase arrangements with for specific dates and times.
So after all that is accounted for, after we look at our load, after we look at our slice and our forecast for slice and block, and all of our other resources, the difference between that number and the number that we think we need, we would go out and procure the forward energy. So there are options, those transactions that I talked about at the start.
AKA market.
Market, yeah. Yep.
Market, but buying the futures market, not the
futures, not day ahead,
not the day ahead,
yeah.
Market, which is what we're trying to do.
So, just a note here that even though we're doing this, there will be moments where we're going to need to go on to the market in the day ahead in real time to do that kind of balancing. We are not set up to protect against every possible scenario, but we are definitely stronger, set up stronger than we were last year for those types of scenarios. Okay, so let's look at the last 6 months first at our resources. This shows you from April to end of September what our resources provided versus what our planned values were. Overall, we're at 90% of what our planned values were. We can see some select resources there to kind of dig into some of the numbers in more detail. You can see that the first quarter was a little bit lower versus what we saw in July, August, and September, getting pretty close to what our planned values were, 97%. This is good for us because, you know, typically these are going to be higher market conditions as well. So if there's any months that I'd rather see lower resources, probably May, June, where markets are probably depressed. That's our overall outlook. You can see that wind was a little bit lower than planned, typically 86%. And it's generally how our supply went. Any questions on the supply graph there?
Questions, commissioners?
So other resources would be solar.
It would be like a small hydro, typically. Yeah.
Small.
Yeah. Okay.
Not at this point.
Yeah, just actually go back. Just an observation. So let's pick the end of April where the supply is below the plan.
Mm-hmm.
But part of that is it's planned in the moment, perhaps, right? If the weather is warm and our demand is low, we are choosing to generate less at Jackson. Or Bonneville may be putting less water through the system because the region doesn't have a need.
So this would be the month ahead planned output. So if we look at what we expect at the end of March, in the case of April,
mm-hmm.
that would be that value. So it's kind of like our, we would take our long-term expectation and tune that up for what we would expect during the month. Knowing that we're going to have some variation in the month, that's what that planned value is.
The planned value, but the actual value could be deliberately low too. I guess that's my question.
Yes.
Okay.
So we could have some operational decisions, you know, particularly when we look at July and August, and we're thinking, you know, we could have some price excursions here, and we have a choice of, you know, holding back in June or something like this, then we can make those choices, and that would be represented in the actuals there.
Thank you.
Yep. In case of loads, then we see that over the periods, we actually had pretty good the forecast of actual versus our month ahead. So looking at the table there, the bottom two rows are what I'm focusing on here. We do a monthly mid-month and end-of-month update for what we expect the next month's loads are going to be on average. And so reading across there, average, we were hitting it on the mark, but had a little deviation from month to month, but no more than about a 5% deviation from what we expect there. And that really occurred in August, where we had that 95% of what we expected. In terms of budget, this would be a forecast that was done earlier in the year when we do the budget. And we can see, again, pretty good comparison between the forecast and actuals. A couple of highlights to point out. Our peak week happened unsurprisingly at the start of the year the period here in April, where we had a slightly colder than normal period. But as you can see, temperatures kind of rose throughout this period, leveled off in mid-August and started tapering off at the end. And we really didn't have a peak load week that competed with the early April one, where it was kind of colder. And so we did have a peak market week. This is a new thing to the report this time. Just pointing this out, that happened in start of July, where it did coincide with higher than planned loads. But we'll look at how we did as far as trading around that time. But before we get to that, just want to show, you're not meant to kind of look through all the details of all these, but, this looks at the last 5 years and looks at day ahead and real-time prices, right? I already showed you kind of some of the variation that we see, and this is kind of another way of looking at the same thing, is when do we see prices sort of rise and fall? And, as before, we can see most of the prices are down at the bottom of the graph there, right, with both real-time and day-ahead prices. But we have these moments which kind of jump out at you. Kind of hard to see, but 2024 so far in the year is in that salmon color. You can see the January price excursions from the LRK weekend. You see some other excursions from prior years there, too. So that's what we've seen over the last 4 years or so. And that allows us to kind of benchmark what we've seen over the last 6 months. So the question is, how have prices gone over the last 6 months? Is this high? Is this low? And that's what those shades are telling you, that probability key. So the red, which is the kind of light red, is the very unusually high prices. One in 20 is like 95% of the time prices are going to be below that. And the green area in those graphs show you that 75% of the time prices are going to be below that. So let's look at the day ahead price graph on the top there. And you can see that for the most part, January, February, March, April, May, June, prices pretty much stayed within day ahead prices within our expected ranges, right? Some variation, but no major excursions, out of that range. When we had our July price spike there, you can see that it goes into that red range and actually goes up to beyond that. So we have some pretty high price moments there. We also, as you can see, the graph is a little bit confusing there with the x-axis. So I think that's actually incorrect. The second excursion there on right-hand side is in September, November. So excuse that mistake there. So that's kind of what we saw. We also had some real-time variability too. That's on the bottom hand side, mostly at about the same times, early July, early September, with a couple more momentary excursions in end of July and early August there.
So the last one, the September one, is different than the others because the real-time price and the day ahead of price were almost identical. Can you talk about why that might be?
I can just say that it can be a choice between taking a day ahead price or real time price, and sometimes it makes sense to do one or the other if you know you're going to have to transact. The actual tactics for doing that, I can probably defer to our senior manager of our scheduling on that, or if you want to add any commentary to it.
So I guess that gets to my question of what we're looking at, because I was thinking these are the market day ahead prices, not just those available. So I mean, it's not just the homage driving this.
Nope. These are the prices that would be available at NIT-C, which is where we would be trading at. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Well, no, it actually doesn't answer the question. Why would they be similar then?
Why would they be similar to you?
Why would they be the same amount?
Yeah, good morning. Ryan Kyle, senior manager of power scheduling. So we could see prices be the same or different for real time and day ahead for a number of different reasons. There's no correlation to them being the same. But typically what we do see is that real time prices will follow day ahead prices because that's what the market has done leading into that day.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't give the market a lot of reason to be doing something at a high price in the day ahead and then do something at a low price in real time. There's no value there. In that September time period, if I remember correctly, we had a couple outlier prices in the day ahead. It was very hot. It was Labor Day weekend or around there. And so that's why you see it spike up there. And in real time, you probably saw a similar thing where an evening peak price for a single hour could have been exceptionally high for any number of reasons.
Okay. So they're not necessarily even at the same hour.
Correct.
Okay. Good.
Yeah. And day ahead prices will be in blocks of 8 or 16 hours, whereas the real time will be single hour prices.
Okay.
So there could be any number of reasons for a real time price to be spiked on a single hour.
Thank you. That makes a lot of
sense.
Thanks, Ron. Any other questions before I move on? Okay. So let's have a look at our peak load week. As I said, this was start of April, where we had the kind of coldest weather of the period. So we pulled this out as our single highest load demand during a single week here in the last 6 months. We also show the market prices as well. And so for this period, our peak week had a 894 megawatts reading at 10 a.m. on April 4th. We can see the prices were actually pretty muted during that period of time. The peak price for day ahead was $50 and $60 for real time. We were a net buyer over the period, however. So not really too much to write home about, but that was our peak week, and I'm glad to say that everything seemed to be pretty muted when it came right down to it.
So just going back to that dimensionless graph we looked at earlier, that's not a month where we have an inordinate amount of reserves.
So you're referring to our reserve comparison, typically April is not a month that we have a huge amount of reserves. However, you can see that compared to our past reserves, it's about 1.5 times as large.
Yeah.
So we did end up going into that month with more than we had in the previous year. Okay. So the new thing is we're looking at the peak price week as well. So what happens when we, take the, over the last 6 months, the moment that had the highest prices over a whole week. And as I said, that was a close comparison here, but taking an early July, 4th of July weekend, saw the most elevated markets. We did see a $350 day ahead price and $156 real time price. In this case, over the whole period, we were a net seller. And our prices, as you can see, when you take the different heavy load and light load prices and average those out, you can see in the graph on the bottom right there. So that was our peak price week that we saw. Again, being a net seller when prices are high is a good thing. Let's hope it's all always like that. All right, having a look at our risk test now. So we have a series of tests that we do looking at the financial risk that we have for our different positions and taking into account the market variations that we see. And this is our financial load and balance test. So we have resources that are higher than loads. We have an open position. And this test shows whether the value is above or below the limits that we set. These are monthly limits, which are a derivative of our annual limits that we calculate. And the value of these open positions will be changing depending on the prices in the market, right? And in addition, whether or not our forecasts are changing, depending on whether or not we have more or less resources or we have a load forecast and so forth. So we do a test on that daily and keep records of that. And then, so each one of these dots here represents a record of that test. The metric that we're using is the percentage of the limit. So I drew in a line at 100% there. So over that would be an exceedance of that limit. Below that would be no exceedance. And so in this case, when we look at the next 18 months here, and I chose 18 months, prior reports, we've looked at annual and quarterly, but given our impending move to load following, really this takes us to September of 2025, right? And you can see that there are some exceedances as we go along in the kind of 3 to 6 months ahead view. These are all related to us trying to meet our targets. And so when that happens, we err on the side of having that extra length, even if our test would tell us to otherwise go and transact to reduce that value. So this is in some ways a result of us saying, okay, we're going to have higher targets, also representative of just generally higher markets that we've seen, even though there's been some downward movements with prices last period.
Peter, we have some members of the public watching online. Can you define open position? This is challenging stuff to layperson, including us, I think, to understand.
Sure thing. So I guess the easiest way to put it is, if we started out saying, we have resources and loads, if they were exactly equal, we have no open position, we'd be neutral, net zero on that, right? If we have more resources, or if we go out and acquire energy for that month, we start having an open position. So anything which is away from, deviating away from that sort of net zero position will be an open position. So it can go both ways. We can have an open short, we can have an open long. Open short means that we don't have enough to meet our loads. Open long would be we have more than we need. Now, just to remind you though, we also have targets which tell us to hold more than we need all the time as we go into the month, so that we aren't exposed to kind of the price variation that we might have. And because we know that despite our best efforts in forecasting, there's going to be some error, and we want to make sure that we're not too exposed when that happens as well, too. Does that help?
Thank you, Ian.
Okay. So we also look at prices in particular. There's a test we do called the price exposure test. We look at when we have long positions, we have more than we need, typically most of the time. Those are the blue dots, and also short position tests. So in the rare circumstance that we don't yet have what we need, but we're planning to purchase for it, we do a test where we say, okay, let's assume prices move up or down. The wrong way, according to what we have. If we have extra energy and we see prices go down, then that position would lose value, right? And so we look at our past prices to do that, and we say, okay, this is the kind of volatility that we might see, and we say, okay, well, given that, let's do a 2-standard deviation price change, which is a pretty significant price change, and what would the lost value of that be, okay? And in the circumstance that it is a large value, we would be posed with the question, maybe we should go and transact to make sure that future doesn't happen. In the case of this test, we didn't have any sort of exceedances on these monthly basis, which would have had us going and asking that question. So that tells us that the combination of prices, our open positions that we have, and the volatility in those prices was low enough that that didn't come up this time.
How is the red line determined?
So the red line is a derivative of our annual, of our annual limits that we set. So the annual limits are set on, we look at historical price volatility, and we look at our revenues that we have historically brought in. And then we look at how much price volatility and how much loss would we have in these positions to precipitate or require us to have a 3% rate increase. And this would be a contribution of that. So this would be a monthly contribution of it. So if we looked at this on an annual basis, all these months all together, and we said, okay, this is above the red line, then we say, if that scenario happens, we might need a 3% rate increase because of revenues that we thought would come in but didn't come in as a result of that.
But for the record, that's 3% just based on the cost to procure energy or sell energy. It's just 3% on energy.
Not the rates.
It's not, not all the other things that impact rates.
It would be everything that goes into our revenue requirement, which is our what we get from our budget, right? So if we look at our past revenues, then that includes all of our costs.
Can we modify that? Maybe that's one of the things we're going to do. Didn't the board bring its governance policy update modify that?
No, sorry.
With regard to rate?
It's
based on
something. Scott, please introduce yourself.
Sorry, Scott Jones, PED Chief Financial Officer. We've talked about this quite a bit, about whether to change this. There are some other risk exposure things that are sitting out there, but very specifically for this one, the way the model is set up is we don't raise a red flag essentially until the risk exposure gets to that point. And Peter can clarify this better than I can, but that doesn't mean that you're automatically losing. It just means that at one point in time, if the total potential exposure that we're seeing out there in the market hits that threshold, then we're raising the red flags and taking action. But we have to set that threshold somewhere. A lot of entities set it in a lot of different ways. We have chosen to set it based on a, and I don't mean this word as bad as it sounds, but it's an arbitrary number that we have decided this is our guardrail, and it's equivalent to about the value of a 3% rate increase. Really, it's translated to a dollar amount. And we're saying, how much is a 3% rate increase translated to dollars? There's the dollar exposure. If all of our market stuff adds up to an exposure that hits that number, then we pause and raise a red flag.
So is this telling me we're conservative, or is it telling me that we're more progressive?
No, I would say we're fairly conservative. Yeah. Yeah. That would be my perspective. Would you agree?
Yes, I would agree. I think what we've seen, thank you, Scott, for that explanation. I think what we see here, when we look at this graphic that there are some exceedances. Then we have some kind of conflicting priorities there, where again, we sort of err on the side of saying, we're gonna have more energy if we need it, versus what the model itself would drop directly out of the model. So I think even in that case, we are saying that we are more conservative. There is, however, a potential downside of if we do see price changes and we have extra length and the price changes go the wrong way over time, then that would be a loss of revenue. But you know, when we sort of balance those two things on either hand, we say, well, what kind of within month excursions have we seen in the past? We weigh ourselves on the side of protecting against that more than the kind of longer term price changes that we see here with these exceedances.
Thank you very much. I was mixing the 3% up with something else. So thank you for clarification.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I don't understand is, okay, you wanted to explain that open short being different from open long. Mm-hmm. So if you're open long, and you have adequate supply, why is it open at all? I mean, it would be open short seems like a redundancy. Mm-hmm. I mean, open long seems like a redundancy.
Yeah, that's a.
Is that crazy?
It's not crazy at all. Great question. So we have to balance, you know, reliability as well as financial outcomes, right? Here in this program, what we're trying to do is minimize that risk of financial outcomes. Mm-hmm. But we also, you know, when it comes to short positions, you know, there are different options for allowing ourselves to either purchase ahead of time, go out, procure in the long term to get those resources, or to wait until other markets are available, day ahead markets. So we can go into a particular month with a short position, knowing that we're going to be able to buy on the market, right? That puts us at, you know, exposed to that market more, right? And so, I lost my train of thought a little bit here. And so, in any case, what we're trying to do is sort of manage those types of risks between those different types of markets.
With more refinement.
And sort of refine as we go along here. So we usually position ourselves so in case markets in the short term, which have higher volatility, are volatile and prices are high, we have some price certainty and also energy certainty way ahead of time. So that's why we typically don't go into that month, because if we get an MLK weekend and we haven't set ourselves up long, we set ourselves up exactly to what we think we have in a month, then actually what's happening in the month is it's going to have all this volatility, and we might not be buying 100 or 200 megawatts. We might be buying a whole lot more at very high prices. So, but the downside is, of course, then most of the time we expect that we are going to need less. That means we're going to be selling, right? And so we sort of make this kind of trade-off. There's a trade-off to make, and we try to hit that balance, right? So, and so, you know, as you've seen over the last few presentations, we've been making some incremental improvements to the plan. I think that's next couple of slides here to try to position ourselves better based off of our experience here.
Hey, Peter, maybe I'll just add one thing. You know, over the last couple of years, we've seen, you know, some pretty big events like the Martin Luther King event. We saw the December 2022. We had a pretty low water year there in 2023. So we have made some deliberate decisions, as Peter showed in the presentation, to increase that length that we're taking into, you know, the typical month, especially in those winter months. And that is to avoid, you know, those types of situations where, you know, we get into something like MLK and we want to have enough energy to cover that, so we're buying less in the market. So that's why we're kind of deliberately increasing those targets and holding more length than what the, you know, kind of the average forecast would say we're going to need.
Question, Commissioner?
Well, I think I'll wait until the end of the presentation. Yes, I do.
I could answer questions about this all day. This is great. I appreciate all the interesting questions. All right. Recent risk program improvements to Jason's point here. So an update and what's in store for the future here. So we have applied a forward sales moratorium. So this limits some of the forward transactions that we might want to do. Just thinking about, if you remember, said how we look in this year as far as our position. We have over that 100% amount of volume. And so this would provide some restrictions to just to make sure that we are pacing ourselves with any transactions that we do. And we really limit in vulnerable months the opportunities to accidentally put ourselves short, I guess is the best way to put it. We've also been pretty aggressive at advanced energy and capacity purchases to address our within months risks that we've seen. So we've, as you've seen in that slide, we've gone ahead and set ourselves up really well. So we could have waited longer according to our flight path, our normal approach of doing things, but we've done some advanced purchases to get ourselves there. And we've also completed our anti-market manipulation training. This is a requirement as part of the risk program, so just reporting on that. When we look to the future, load following is coming up, and so we're thinking about how does the risk program need to be transitioned for the change in regime, and what's the appropriate right size for the PD for that. And we've also made the decision to halt the financial hedging program, just given the pending change to load following significant effort to get that up and running for a short period of time. Just didn't make any sense at this point. Okay, got a final question slide. Got to get all those pictures in there.
Questions, Commissioner?
For fun, would you go back to number 10?
Slide 10, sure.
And by the way, these are awesome photographs.
Thank you.
Who got those? Did Hartford come help you with that?
No, this is a open source Microsoft. thank you. Thanks to Microsoft for that.
Yeah.
Okay, so different people look at charts in different ways. So how do you think the 20-month-old looked at that one? He was looking at slides with me yesterday.
The 20-month-old? Rainbow?
Choose your train.
Oh, yeah, all right.
It's your train.
Yeah, with the smoke box and everything. Yeah.
Peter, it's obvious, right? But anyway, it was fun because, yes, I was babysitting, but I was also trying to get my head around a lot of this, so.
I'm going to show this to my daughter. I haven't exposed her to this one yet, so we'll see what she says to that.
Yeah, different perceptions.
Yes. You need to start a lot early.
We're working on X and Y.
You keep searching.
Any other questions?
Well, clarification. Just want to make sure Tony understands this. This risk that you're managing post-October 2025 with load following is shifted to Bonneville. That's my understanding.
Yeah, quite a lot of it. We have these market risks. So this is the primary thing we're looking at. Price is changing, our load's changing, our resource is changing. So that whole problem is going to be simplified to something a lot smaller, which is what can we do to optimize versus the BPA tariff that we have. We still might have some opportunities. This might not be part of the risk program, it's part of the transition questions here, but how do we keep our costs, which are, we feel that Bonneville sends to us, as low as possible, the things, the resources that we have available and the engagement with customers that we can do.
Okay.
Yeah. But it simplifies that whole problem to a much smaller capsule.
So then is our plan to, we have things that are out longer. Are we not purchasing from the market?
BPA will be responsible for our loads. Our
right, but
service, yeah.
We are on our current plan, which we are looking at into the future, and we're making some commitments out. I don't know how far out.
I think this is probably something that's could be better answered by the IRP team and kind of how they're answering those types of questions. But as we get further out, I think that's probably where we'll start to look at, you know, how does that process take into account our new reality and what types of investments are needed in that sort of long-term framework to make the most sense for us.
What if we have something left? Is that...
Yeah, so if we're looking at, you know, like post-October 1st, 2025, we're not out making purchases to kind of balance our loads and resources as we are today.
But we are up until then. If we have something that we've committed to purchase,
so
hanging out there, I'm assuming there's a wonderful plan to not end up with that.
Well, I mean, we knew about that date, and we're planning towards that date.
Okay,
there is some planning for post that date, depending on the resource. We still are talking about, but we're certainly making sure that we're prepped as much as we can with transactions out there, so that we don't have anything that we shouldn't have hanging along.
Some things that, you know, we will have still would be like our wind contracts that we entered into years ago.
Yeah.
But these more short-term market purchases, you know, that we have been making for this upcoming winter and things like that, we're making those to extend into, you know, next year on and after October 1st.
Does Bonneville then manage our wind projects as well? Does that fall under, or do we continue to?
Garrison and the power supply team are doing a bunch of analysis on what's the best way to handle those in the future.
Okay.
And we'll be working through that, and then we can report out.
Okay, Tony.
Energy Northwest has wind. So.
Right, but it's not wind that we buy.
No, but BPA buys.
No, those their projects have individual owners.
Okay.
So they build a project and they manage the project, but the owners, all their projects are different.
Good.
And Packwood, we're an owner in that one, but we're not an owner in their other projects.
Mm-hmm.
No question, just an observation. Every time this is fascinating and I've learned something. I mean, this is a PhD dissertation in
he has one.
I understand. Thanks. It just the trade-offs of holding energy, not holding energy, options. I mean, it's just all, it's fascinating, right? We probably miss more opportunities to sell at a profit than we do. Because the risk is so great.
Plus we're
some
conservative.
Of these events. Anyway.
We don't make a profit.
It's fascinating. Well, profit, I meant. It's somehow more than we had to purchase it for.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. It's a team effort. I'm standing up here, but we meet regularly and discuss these topics, and this is the brainchild of several folks here.
You do amazing work. Thank you.
Well, I'm thrilled that we have, you know, you, Scott, and Felicia, and all three of these presentations today. It's really,
mm-hmm.
We have these presentations, but we don't always have them together. And this is a really good way to immerse ourselves into all of this. Thank you, whoever's idea that was.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Peter. And up next, we have Lisa Ann Dean, Principal Economist, in their 2025 Load Forecast.
Great. Okay, I'm Felicia Ng, economist in the Rates and Economics Department, and I'm here to talk to you about 2025 load forecast. So the purpose of this presentation today is just to update the board on the latest long-term load forecast. There's no expectations, just purely informational. And the agenda for today, we'll start with our usual format. We'll go over our economic environment before going into each of the sector forecasts. So starting with population, the current Snohomish County population is around 870,000 people. Last year, we did see a population growth of around 7,300, which comes out to about 0.85% growth. That is a bit lower than what we've seen in the last couple of years, which is usually around 1 to 1.5%. Migration did slow down quite a bit last year. About 3,000 of our population growth came from net migration in 2023, which is about half or even less than half than what we've seen in prior years. There's no clear indication as to why that happened, but we can safely assume that high cost and high interest rate had something to do with it.
Housing.
Mm-hmm. As for the future, the county is still expecting to reach 1.2 million people by 2045, where annual growth over the next 10 years will be around 1.5 to 2%. Moving on to our current labor market conditions, unemployment rate for Snohomish County was at 4.6% in August. It has pretty much been trending around the 4% range all throughout the year. It is a bit higher than what we saw last year, but still within what we would consider the natural rate of unemployment. But overall, job growth is proceeding at a slower pace, much slower than what we saw coming out of the pandemic period. The labor market isn't as tight as last year, but for the most part, anybody who's looking for a job is able to find something. Here's a look at our unemployment rate historically and the outlook of it. So, in solid blue bars, we have the historical unemployment, and a dashed bar is the forecasted unemployment. So last year, we were forecasting that unemployment would settle around the 3 to 3.5%, but economists in our regions have now updated that outlook to be closer to 4.5%. So yes, it is higher than last year, but we would consider that to be a more sustainable rate going into the long run.
What's the time period for the percentages on page 5? Is that 2024 up to date, or is that 2023?
For the 4.6?
Yeah.
That's August of this year.
August, okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Is there much of a connection between the unemployment rate and our load forecast?
That would trickle into the type of, like, the new premises that we forecast, because that's kind of an input to our model. So things like employment, just like sales around the county or building permits, those are all kind of inputs to our model.
Can I ask you a question about, again, I'm always often thinking about how we get information. So when you come up with the 817,000, not you, but when that number is put out there, is that based on the 2020 census, which was during COVID?
You mean the population one?
The population.
That's based on
117,000.
Yeah, so it's based on the Washington State agencies. We usually get stuff from the labor department or the employment services department. And then what other data we get from like the department. Licensing, or in the census plays on some of the surveys that we use for the data that we're going to show here. So we just grab from a little bit of everywhere.
Yeah, because I think the census part of it, whatever those inputs were, they were low because we had a lot of Spanish speaking people and other and refugees coming in who were not part of the count. So my guess is it's probably already closer to a million because someone didn't get counted and aren't being counted. But that's people, not necessarily our customers.
Right, that's the population. Yeah.
I just things like that a lot.
So to inflation, so inflation we saw it peak 2 years ago at 9.1%, and it's now finally trending to the right direction. Inflation in the US for August was measured at 2.5%. The most stubborn part of inflation, I would say, is housing related costs that actually went up in August by 0.5%. So it's no surprise as to why the Seattle metro area's inflation is slightly higher than the nation at 3.1%. We're still experiencing pretty tight housing market around here. But seeing that the economy is expanding at a solid pace and that employment is at a sustainable level, the Fed did decide to lower the interest rate for the first time in 4 years. So that puts our current Fed's funds rate at around 4.75% to 5%. And there are two more meetings left in the year. So there is speculation that there could be two more with maybe smaller rate cuts coming this year to support economic growth. So we'll have to wait and see about that. But the last rate cuts that we saw is already been felt in the mortgage rates currently. Last year, mortgage rates peaked at around 7.75%. It has now come down to roughly 6%. So a really good sign for home buyers, should spark more activity in the housing market. But it's also a really good thing for our housing production in the area. We've seen data saying that building permits have been on a decline over the last 2 years. So we saw residential permitting peaked in December of 2021, and it dropped by almost half in June of 2023. So this decline is definitely not due to the lack of demand, but rather the result of higher costs and interest rates, making it pretty difficult for developers to finance new projects. In fact, here's another look at our housing needs in the area. The bar graph on the left shows housing production and population growth over the last couple of decades in the Puget Sound area. And as you can see, the darker blue bars, which represent our housing supply, it hasn't kept up with demand at all for the last couple of decades. In fact, Washington State Commerce estimates that the Snohomish County area would need about 160,000 new housing units in order to accommodate our 20-year population projections. On the right is just another data point showing our current housing shortage in the area. This table shows Snohomish County listings and sales for September of 2024. And the column labeled month supplies kind of gives us an idea of the inventory level in our county. As you can see, we're mostly under 1.5 months worth of supply, which means there's a clear shortage of home in this area and probably will continue to be an issue as our population grows. Here's a look at the type of housing that are being built in our area. This chart shows housing production by type for the last 20 years in Puget Sound area. And so far in 2024, about 67% of all new housing units have been multi-family structures. And as you can see from the growing purple bars on the chart, that pretty much has been the trend for the past decades or so. But meanwhile, single family homes have remained pretty steady at 6,000 to 8,000 homes per year. So this distinction of the type of homes that are being built is important to us because multifamily homes such as duplexes or townhomes tend to consume about 50% less than single family homes. And that difference is even larger if we would compare to apartments, which consume about 45% less. Quick update on electric vehicles in our county. Right now, we have just about 25,000 EVs registered in the county, which is on track with our current forecast. So we're continuing to see this 40 to 45% year-over-year growth in EVs. And so far in 2024, we've had about 4,500 new EVs registered. And we are currently forecasting that that number will go to about 8,000 by the end of the year. As far as our long-term forecasts, our assumptions have not changed, so we're still expecting roughly 700,000 feet on the road by 2040.
A thought came to mind. These are consistent with projections I've seen in my readings in several, from several publications or agencies. I really struggle with this kind of saturation without a backbone system. You know, and so, you know, the meters and the, I mean, the chargers and stuff. I don't see that happening.
You mean kind of chargers out in public areas?
Well, yeah, the public, and I call it, sorry, my electricity background.
Yeah.
I mean, I would think you'd have to have an extensive one if you're up to that percentage.
Yeah. I mean, these are just my own personal observations. I think they're getting more chargers put out there along kind of the major interstates and things like that. And certainly there's charging places in cities. Tesla has a pretty good network. But I think there's
not a lot, though.
opportunity there and opportunity for,
charging
at higher kind of rates of power.
To support that kind of
transition.
That's a great observation. I think the challenge, if we go back to the previous slide, really is I think most vehicles are charged at people's homes. That's the orange part. If you live in a multifamily unit, you may or may not. I know there's some bits of code work to provide charging, or at least to provide for the possibility of adding charging. But I think that's the real challenge, is how are all those apartment dwellers going to have access to charging?
So on E&E News, I think I was just looking for it, but I think they said they expect that by 2030, there would be 30% of all autos would be EVs.
All the new EVs, yeah. That's when the menu comes into play. That's when the new regulation comes into play, where manufacturers have to, all new vehicles have to be EVs, or EV, like plug-in hybrids as well.
Yeah.
So that's when in our forecast we see kind of a stronger switchover.
Okay.
It's not a question, it's just an observation, scratching my head. I don't know how they're going to support that.
Well, I think that, what we have to plan for is built in our grid out for all those chargers that are homes. Because that's going to, put more load on our distribution system, transformers that you see around neighborhoods, those sorts of things.
Are we really linked into some kind of a network where we know when purchases made, like a dealership supposed to notify us? Probably not.
We can get back to you on that one.
No. It's
just
my rambling.
Well, no, it's an interesting topic because it's a challenge. I did listen to, I don't know what it was, a podcast or something, and they're talking about in some markets, like around Washington, D.C., buildings for rent, condos, those kinds of townhouses and apartments that have charging are more valuable to customers. People want electric cars, so they're paying more. And so, that's a potential thing that could happen in our service territories. And the desire for electric cars by individuals may drive additional charging in residential multifamily.
Yeah, and I do think that a lot of the new housing units, they're being required to kind of wire and support those. I believe that's in the code. So we're seeing that kind of hit our, when we do a new plat or something like that.
Okay. So remote work is something we always like to keep an eye on as well, as it does impact our residential consumption. The census does a household pulse survey, which showed that about 35 to 45% of Washington state workers are currently working from home. And of those, 50% telework 5 days a week. So they're basically fully remote. And the other half is pretty much split between 1 to 2 days to 3 to 4 days working from home. But you may have heard recently that Amazon have announced that they are going to require their employees to return to the office 5 days a week. Similarly, City of Seattle announced a 3 day a week policy. But on the other hand, we have other companies like Microsoft and I believe Google as well, who have stated that they're sticking to their flexible hybrid work model. So it'll be really interesting to see how everything shakes out for these major employers around here. Well, it's something we'll keep monitoring and make sure we capture any changes to our load forecast.
I found this slide fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking, oh, a skier. A lot of people want to ski and telework in Colorado. But then I started thinking about Minnesota. It's too cold to get out and go to work. I don't know. I just started to look at this and it would be interesting to get behind it and find out why do so many people telework.
I'm sure that it might depend a lot on the industries.
There's a lot of recreation in Colorado.
I looked at this and I wonder how can traffic have gotten so much worse in the last 2 years. Where everybody is not having to drive to work.
Yes.
Where they actually work in their cars, they're in Zoom meetings going down the road, looking at their screens. That's terrifying as well. It's fascinating graphic thing.
Yeah, it is.
All right, so moving on to our load forecast. So for this next couple of charts, you'll see the solid blue line is our historical actuals. The dash blue line is our forecast, and the dash gray line is our last year's forecast. So for residential, we're seeing very, very minimal change compared to last year's forecast. The expected population growth that we talked about has already been captured in our previous forecast. There was a small increase to our new premises, but combine that with our adjustment for a slightly more multifamily mix of homes, the net impact of that was small. And as for our EV and electrification, our assumptions for those have not changed, so the forecast in those areas stayed relatively the same. For the commercial side, we're looking at a roughly 1% increase on average over the next 10 years. There was a small upward adjustment to our new premises, and that's derived from our macroeconomic factors. And then there was a new commercial load identified by key accounts. For the industrial forecast, so the big drop that you're seeing here is the removal of the recycling plant that we originally had in the forecast. So just to be clear, we already had that off of our forecast last year. We did mention it at our presentation last year, but it just didn't make it onto the chart here. So I wanted to show this drop here just so that we all start from the same point of reference. Internally for planning and trading purposes, that has been off of our forecast already. The other item is, which you may have heard of, is Naval Fusion Everett is planning to bring in 12 new vessels over the span of 10 years, with the first ship expected to come in 2028. So as the new ships come in, the current ones will start to vacate the port, but overall we will see a net increase in the number of ships that are gonna be docked in Everett. And the last item is the delay of Boeing 737 MAX assembly line, which we had forecasted to come in this year and next. But with obviously with everything that's going on with Boeing, we went ahead and punted that vote further. And just as a side note, I know there's a lot of things going on with Boeing right now with the layoffs and the strike. And while that does have an impact to our load in the short term, we like to proceed pretty carefully when it comes to adjusting our long-term load forecasts until we have more certainty around Boeing's long-term outlook.
So the 75,000 Boeing's layoff, that's nationwide. So how many people local, isn't it? So I think that's.
There are Boeing plants now that are not being formed. There are Boeing plants in the South that were not being. No.
They're not offended. They're not muted. I don't need it. Please go ahead with your question. I believe it's 17,000 folks locally. Okay, that's, I don't know about if they're all local, but just 17,000 is the number of seats.
Oh.
For the number of layoffs.
Okay, thanks.
So,
back real quick to the residential forecast.
Yes.
So, you know, looking at this, it's sort of a nice steady increase. And then if you slip, if you want to head to the commercial forecast, I find this fascinating. So, you know, a very straight growth rate that's plateaued and actually dropped a little bit. Is that conservation? Any thoughts about, is it the mix of commercial customers? Or?
It's a conservation that when we see the forecast drop a little bit, yeah, it has to do with conservation or our expected energy efficiency that is going to come in.
That's huge. Thank you.
So putting it all together, we have a total forecast with historical actuals going all the way back to 1969 in solid colors. The dashed colors are forecast, and the dotted gray line again is our last year's forecast. So we are showing a decrease because we have to account for that recycling plant going away. But if we take that out of the picture, we'd actually be showing a small increase for the Navy and the commercial load that we just talked about.
Interesting. Go ahead.
Historically, hasn't there, commercial is going to be down, right?
It's going to be slightly up, actually. Small, 1% increase. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks.
That's fascinating, the impact that Kimberly-Clark made.
Yes.
Yeah.
Our peak is... It's back then, so that we're not going to reach it again. So, 4 or 5 years from now.
So this chart here summarizes all the driving factors that are impacting our load forecast. So anything above the zero axis is an increase to our forecast. Anything below is a decrease. And as you can see, some of the big ticket items that are driving our forecast up is population growth and electric vehicles, of course. And things that are keeping it down, energy efficiency, codes and standards, and a little bit coming from rooftop solar as well. But overall, as you can see from the dotted gray line going across, we are expecting our forecast to be going up on the net. Okay, so the last thing we want to talk about is our peak forecast and some of the improvements that we are making to it. So generally here in this forum, we talk about our kilowatt hour consumptions, but peak forecasting is also very important to us, especially as electrification and EV continue to grow. It's really going to highlight our need to focus on peak capacity planning for system planning and also looking for ways to mitigate those peaks as much as we can through innovative rates. So throughout this whole year, we've been meeting with our system planning group, working with them pretty closely and identified some improvements that we can make to our peak forecasting methodology. And as you can see, we've graphed on the right here our actual peaks for the last couple of years in the shaded area. And our original forecast is that black line going across it. And as you can see, our forecast actually does pretty well throughout the year, but it does miss some of those big winter peaks, which are the ones that system planning worry about the most. So we've decided to move away from our static method to a probabilistic method, where we run our model through thousands of iterations using historical weather years. And the result of that is the other three lines that you see on the graph. So we have the P50 in the yellow, the P95 in the blue, and the P98 in the orange. And as you can see, in order to really capture those large winter peaks, we would have to move towards a P95 forecast, or maybe more. And a P95 means that 95% of time we expect our peak to come in at or below the forecast, and only 5% of time would it be above that. So going forward, we are exploring using this P95 forecast in the future on our But there are a couple of other improvements that we are currently working on. The first one is the disaggregation of our residential, commercial, industrial forecasts within the peak model. So currently our peak forecast is derived from our load forecast at a total level and then assigning it and using a average system load shape. But as you can see from the chart on the side here, a residential load shape is very different from a commercial shape or industrial shape. So by separating those three components differently, separately and assigning it the corresponding shape, we can be much more accurate in our peak forecast.
Ms. Grab, now I get it. Okay. I think in a previous meeting, John was talking about something else and I didn't get it.
So other improvements that's going to be in the work is we could do the same thing with our EV forecasts. So our EV load right now is baked into our residential forecast. But as you can imagine, EV charging is very different from your typical household load. So again, separating that out is going to give us a much better forecast, especially as EV continues to be so prominent. The same thing could be done with other load items such as solar or just other electrification. So that's something that we're also considering as an improvement to our model. But aside from making having a better peak forecast, these improvements will also allow us to test impacts of future rate constructs such as climate day rates. So these are some of the things that we're also working on besides the load forecast, and we just wanted to share with you so you're aware of it.
So are data centers included in industrial or commercial?
They would probably fall into commercial.
Commercial. So data centers. So those are driving up the demand in some parts of our state, but not specifically here yet.
Because of our rate.
But it does affect the BPA. BPA affects us. So, I just wonder if we're under appreciating the effect of data centers. Does that come into your thinking, or do you get any information about the effect of data centers?
Well, data centers are a pretty large load usually. But data centers usually tend to be pretty flat load because they're just running all the time. But as far as data centers coming into our county, you usually hear about those from our key accounts group. But other parts of the states, I know they're setting up.
Yeah, that's huge.
Maybe I would just add, definitely from kind of a regional perspective, as we see more of those data centers come online and come into the area, that's going to be a big factor in, kind of the planning we do for the future, resource adequacy, all those types of things.
We're not really isolated in that business.
Yeah, that is correct. I mean, they're attached to the system, and I think there can be different agreements for how do they behave when we get into kind of a resource adequacy type of situation.
Mm-hmm.
Are they able to go on backup generation, those types of things? Those could be some beneficial things that could benefit the grid in the future.
Large load. I thought maybe we'd drop that. I thought there was some, maybe in a line extension rights or something like that large load out as a separate item.
That's correct. Yeah, we do have kind of a couple of policies there, kind of line of demarcation being 10 megawatts, so larger than 10 megawatts,
okay,
and smaller than 10 megawatts, kind of between 2.5 megawatts up to 10. Some different ways that those things are treated and how we work through the process.
That's it for me. So if there's any other questions, happy to take them.
Any questions, Commissioner?
No, we've already bombarded you with so many. So Thank you very much.
Just a comment, it would seem like as our smart meters get deployed, that'll give you some rich data set for those on that last slide to understand the rooftop solar contribution in real time and EV charging.
Yeah, we're really excited to have more data. I mean, right now we use a lot of our research meter data to do this kind of work, but having more data would be better.
Yeah. Great, great presentation. Thank you. Anything more this morning?
That is all for this morning. Thank you very much.
Okay. It is now 11:20 a.m. and our meeting is recessed. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m.